You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
You are now listening to the Ride or Cry podcast.
How are you doing today?
I'm okay. It's like really humid here in Ohio, and so that just, you know, I normally go on like outdoor walks, but they're kind of untenable right now, and so that's a bit of a downer, but otherwise good. How are y'all?
Good. I mean, we had 3 earthquakes here in the middle of the night.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah, so I used to sleep through anything, but lately that is not the case, and so the second earthquake starts, which is more frequent now than ever before, I'm like out of bed before I even acknowledge what's happening. I've run to the kitchen, I've put on my earthquake backpack, and I'm like ready to go. And it happened 3 times in the middle of the night, so I slept none.
You have an earthquake backpack?
That's
incredible.
I'm very prepared, and it's funny because I put it together earlier this year anticipating a catastrophe, and so when the pandemic hit, I already had a mask. I was so prepared for everything that kind of worked out. Yeah. This is Caro, by the way. I don't think you met her when you did our other panel.
Hey, are you also in Los Angeles? So the earthquakes also hit you.
Well, I was fast asleep and didn't know, which is all. I've almost never felt one in my life. So, I don't, it's odd.
Yeah.
But anyway, should we get started?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So, I mean, thanks so much for being on.
Yeah, we're huge fans of yours. It's like almost to a point of, it's embarrassing how much we talk about you. Caro introduced me to your book, They Can't Kill Us. I think it was 2 years ago, but it also could have been last year because I've completely lost track of time. But
me too. Yeah.
It's so good. And since then, you know, we've been reading your poetry and everything. So we're really stoked to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I guess to start, do you just want to talk a little about like what drew you to writing, how you started writing, and how you started writing poetry specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't start writing poetry until 2011, maybe 2012. So that came so much later in my evolution as a writer. You know, my first forays into writing were in zines on the punk scene I was on, which was the Ohio scene, but by extension, the Midwest scene in general. You know, I think particularly in the early, mid-2000s, there is the Midwest kind of extended, the scene kind of extended to, from like Dayton, Ohio, to Chicago, to Detroit, especially when the band Fireworks got big, or at least like regionally big, to Pittsburgh. And so much of my writing was just kind of like picking up slack on zines, because, you know, everyone loves a zine, but at the height of the scene where I was on, no one wanted to contribute to the zines. You know, it was like one of those things where it's like, It was less, you know, I think there's a type of romanticism around zines now where there's an eagerness to, but here when I was coming up, it was kind of just like, we got to get the zine out, but you know, this person's not going to write for it, and this person's not going to write for it, and this person's definitely not going to write for it. And so that's kind of how I fell into that. But I was writing music reviews for regional papers in the late 00s, early 10s. Not a lot of money, you know, like $50 a review to review records that no one else wanted to review, more than likely. You know, the big, big pop records. You know, music critics didn't often want to fuck with the big pop records because they were so worried about their quote-unquote credibility, you know. So I got those. And eventually I stopped being able to get freelance assignments because editors would complain about the word that was often used was, you know, your writing is too poetic, or it's too meandering, or it kind of like goes, it's circuitous, and it doesn't necessarily stay on the point. And so, you know, I was kind of like, well, you know, I don't really know anything about poetry. I I had started hosting a poetry night in 2011 only because the coffee shop I used to write in, I used to write in this 24-hour coffee shop because I didn't have anywhere else to go, you know? And the guy was like, the owner was like, do you just want to host a poetry night? Because you're here all the time. And I was like, sure. And so I was hosting this poetry night and no longer writing criticism. And I figured I should figure out how to write poetry. So that's kind of how, you know, I started. I didn't study writing in college. I don't have an MFA. I built kind of my own. I just read a lot. I read a lot of poems. A lot.
That's so awesome. One of the main reasons I was so drawn into your writing was because you write a lot about emo and pop punk music, which obviously is like what we do for a living is we throw emo night. And the reason that we started Emo Night was to celebrate these bands and these artists that we grew up listening to that shaped us not only then, but into who we are now as people. And so you can listen to a Yellow Card song, you listen to a Fall Out Boy song and feel nostalgic and be taken back to when you were 16 and you had headphones on and you were, you know, consuming it for the first time. But now you listen to those same songs and you're creating new memories around it and it almost has a second life because the lyrics mean a totally different thing. The music hits you different. Do you find that to be the case as well?
I do. I mean, for better and for worse. For me, sometimes it's for worse, you know. You know, for all the affection that I have for the era of Fall Out Boy that I fell in love with, kind of like from the ground floor, right? Because I was at those early Fall Out Boy shows. It's hard for me to listen to that first Fall Out Boy record, the first full-length record now. You know, I'm like, cringing a little bit.
Yeah. I'm wearing a Fall Out Boy shirt in your honor.
Thank you for that. But the cringing is not necessarily, it's because I was in that place too. You know, I was in a place where it was like my impulses towards emotional anguish was always like trended towards violent imagery or revenge, you know? And an important thing I think that I always tell people is that I'm never ashamed of loving the music I loved when I loved it. I have a lot of gratitude for that. For whatever I loved built a path for me to something else that I loved. So I don't necessarily feel ashamed, but I will say for better or worse. Yeah, I mean, I went to the My Chemical Romance LA show, the reunion thing.
You did?
Yeah.
I was there too.
It was great. I mean, it was one of those very big things for me where, you know, if they ever got back together, I told myself I would go wherever they were. And so
yeah,
I flew across the country.
How iconic was the moment when the curtains fell? And I feel like everyone's heart stopped.
Yeah, it was incredible, you know? And I, you know, some of those songs admittedly didn't hit the same for me, obviously, but some of them hit like exactly the same and then even more so, yeah. Right? And even more importantly, though, when we talk about nostalgia, what I'm most interested in is not necessarily my own personal feelings of nostalgia, though that shows up in my work a lot. What I'm interested in is kind of what I witnessed at the My Chemical Romance show, which is the collective reaction to memory or the collective reaction to reaching for the same kind of emotional conclusion to what people are witnessing. And at that show, it was so wonderful to... For me, because that show was the range of ages was impressive, you know, and exciting to see. Because I imagine, and I'm not out here like pinning ages on people, but just from a cursory glance, I feel like there were some people in the room who maybe were not very old for the first major My Chem run. If we're talking like, if we're talking albums 2 and 3 specifically, right?
Yeah.
And you know, and you could kind of tell it was great because you could kind of tell what era someone arrived at My Chem at, just for kind of looking, you know, you had like the Danger Days kids, and then you definitely could tell, and I say this because I recognize my own, you could tell like the Black Parade folks, the folks who like really fell in love with the Black Parade.
Just like wearing those full-on outfits.
Yeah. There were people like wearing the full, I was
and the makeup.
Yeah.
So impressive.
But there was that moment at the end of the show where you like knew they were going to play Welcome to the Black Parade, the post-encore moment.
Yep.
And to see the collective, like, breath-holding excitement of that, I wouldn't trade that for anything. That was, that alone was worth the trip, you know? Because, you know, for me, that's not even, Welcome to the Black Parade is maybe, I don't know if it's one of my five favorite My Chemical Romance songs, certainly in my 10 favorites, but not, you know, but at the same time, I would not trade seeing that song in that moment for anything. Maybe it is in my top five. I'd have to do the math on that. But I, off the top of my head, it's in my top 10, not five.
Okay, that's fair.
So funny. I used to work in a middle school like 5 or 6 years ago, and like a bunch of those 7th grade and 8th grade kids would wear My Chemical Romance shirts, and I would be like, they were like 12. I'm like, oh, like, how did you come across this? Like what is your experience with this?
It's probably their parents introducing them.
Yeah.
Which is such a crazy thing to think about.
But we're at that point, you know, like, we're at that point where, you know, or older siblings, you know, I grew up, I was fortunate enough. One thing I always tell people is that if you love music, growing up in a house where you're the youngest sibling, if you have like significantly older siblings, especially, it's a real gift if they're into music, of course, mm-hmm. because so much of my music listening habits and so much of the excitement I felt over listening to music was completely honed from an early age. You know, like I knew who The Cure was when I was like 7, you know, and I remember seeing the Smells Like Teen Spirit video for the first time as a kid, as a really small kid. You know, I remember these things. And that too, you know, the thing about memory is like everything, or the reason I write about memory the way I do is because I'm trying to make these slow crawls back to things that remind me that I lived a life that was excited about something, like seeing a music video for the first time, or I mean, gosh, hearing the Black Parade, the album for the first time was, you know, immense for me. Just immense. I mean, that was life changing.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, I mean, my sister, she's barely older than me, but she got me into a lot of the bands that I ended up becoming obsessed with. But I remember one specific day, her boyfriend at the time was driving us home from school, and they put on Calendar Hung Itself. Is that the title, I think, by Bright Eyes? And yeah. I just remember hearing that song and just being so confused, so in love with it, like just a surge of so many emotions. And, you know, I totally became obsessed with that band. But that specific memory I remember is how I was introduced to them. And it's such a nice memory, just driving down PCH, the windows down, and this very intense emotional song comes on. So I totally feel that.
So one of the essays in They Can't Kill Us that stuck with me the most was the one about the Cute Is What We Aim For reunion show that you went to. And it has stuck with me for a long time, just thinking about just the, you know, misogynist culture that was so ingrained in that genre from the beginning. And I guess I'm just wondering if you could speak to like what it would look like to confront that, and like what an inclusive, like a more inclusive scene like looks like to you.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I, you know, it's so funny. I get asked about that the Cute Is What We Aim For thing more than any other thing in the book, I think.
Really?
Yeah. Which is so weird because, you know, going to that reunion show was such a one-off thing. I remember as a different person, or I was not able to confront myself as a person who loved parts of that album that I would not love now. And so there's that. That's one. And two, I mean, I think asking, okay, so I think about Hayley Williams a lot, right? And how her response to Ms. Biz, her response to Misery Business, that came maybe a couple years ago, where she talked about like not loving how the song is aged and wanting to distance herself from it. And my first instinct was, of course, you know, great for Hayley. And I mean, outside of this too, what an honor it has been to witness the growth of Hayley. I mean, for folks who have been on the scene long enough, what an honor to get to witness Hayley Williams' evolution, like repeatedly. You know, I was, gosh, the first, I know I'm diverging, I'm gonna get back to the top. The first time Paramore played Warped Tour, was that I saw them was in Cleveland, like their first year as a band, and it was so great because, you know, they had this tiny little set, but everyone was so excited to see them because there were all these wild rumors floating around about how young they were. It's like, oh, the bassist is 11, and you know, it's like all that kind of thing. But how great to watch her evolve. But when the stuff about Misery Business came out, I remember being like, at any Warped set I was at any Warped year, Misery Business was maybe the, like, not in the top 20 of most problematic songs, you know, in retrospect, you know, in it frustrated me. Again, I say this understanding where Haley's coming from and appreciating it, but it frustrated me that there weren't more men who were on the scene then who had songs worse than that, who were not taking similar responsibility. If only to say, I no longer am operating like this, so I don't fuck with this song like I used to. And I think that's all it takes. Even especially if the work as you age speaks for itself, right? Because some of these dudes, specifically, you know, some of the dudes who were like making songs when I was coming up, they just kind of like aged out of that kind of misogynistic petulance. But they never talk about it,
mm-hmm.
right? Or at least I'm assuming their music has aged out of it. I can't speak to them as people. But they never talk about it. And I think never talking about it perpetuates a lot of mythologies around safety and comfort and accountability. And in talking about it, I think it also requires people to hold their friends accountable when it's uncomfortable, ask their friends to step up. And if their friends are incapable of that, just saying, I'm not fucking with you, you know, because undoubtedly, I mean, who knows when we're going to be going outside for shows or festivals again, but but those spots at last check for me were still uncomfortable for a lot of folks, and still unsafe for a lot of folks, for not just, for like queer and trans folks, for folks of color, specifically Black folks, for women. I mean, it's just like unsafe for a lot of folks. And so, yes, it is really uplifting for me to see people splintering off and building like Black and Brown punk weekends and like girls, like revitalizing Girls to the Front ethos. All that stuff is important and great and thrilling to see. But I think it's also on the men in the scene to hold their homies accountable and make sure that their spaces at all costs, like make sure the spaces are, because essentially what are we asking? We're asking for people to comfortably be able to come out and watch music, or to comfortably be able to be a fan and to not have to detach a part of themselves in order to enjoy something. And I think that doesn't feel like too much to ask for me.
Never. Yeah. I mean, I do think with Haley, and I think the fact that there are so few women in this scene, they are almost put on this pedestal where the expectations out of them are impossible, you know, because you have all the young girls growing up and you have women looking at them as idols and putting these crazy expectations on them to be perfect and to do everything right. And so I think that's why that song had so much, I don't know, pressure on it to, you know, now she doesn't even play that song in her live shows. I think it was last year that she retired playing that song altogether. But yeah, it does seem completely unfair that she's had to do that, whereas a lot of other bands just continue playing these songs that are so incredibly misogynistic.
And I mean, I'm gonna be real, I still listen to Ms. Biz. I like, you know what I mean, like if it comes on, I'm not saying I listen to it every day, but if it comes on, you know, like I'm at a point in my life where there's just a lot that I listen to where I cringe. Not a lot, to be fair. I mean, but there's a decent amount because there's music that I have detached myself from completely and not felt really bad about, you know? To be real, I don't think the cost for me, we all have to do this math, right? This math of like, what is a line that has been crossed that where I no longer feel comfortable consuming this work. And I think a big problem with the way these conversations are approached is they're often approached with self-righteousness, like, well, I gave up this band, and so I am now in a higher plane of morality. When for me, it's never about morality. It's difficult if you have loved the band. It's frustrating to have loved the band and then be disappointed by their actions for me. And so like I took no pleasure in being like, I don't fuck with brand new anymore. I didn't think that that made me morally superior. It made me both angry and a little sad because that was a band that meant a lot to me. But also what some people can separate their listening experience to a point, and I don't fault anyone for that. But I just, it's been harder for me too, especially as I've gotten older. What is your cat's name?
Totally. So his name is Donald Glover, but I've been calling him Cat Guy since
that's a great
probably name. Year one. So it's just Cat Guy.
He loves to be in a Zoom.
He's on every single meeting I have and every podcast and everything. It's very funny.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little about just like what drew you to the punk scene and the emo scene, and then also like over time in your writing, have you found that sometimes you feel taken less seriously for writing about music like punk and emo? Because I feel like it's sort of taken less seriously at large. And so just like, you know, being a writer who writes about that genre.
Yeah, I mean, I fell into the scene. You know, the funny thing that I always say is about myself and my friends is like, when you're young, it's so easy to convince yourself that you are the weirdest person. Where you're like, oh, I'm such an outsider. You know, it's like, oh, I got, my jeans are torn. I'm such an outsider, you know? And so I think when I was younger, when I was like in my teens and early 20s, I thought of myself as this person who no one understood, when that probably like was not true. You know, I think many, many people, I wasn't that complex. But within the scene, I kind of found my people, you know, there. And again, it was like a heyday for in the Midwest. And so, you know, if you had enough gas money to get, there was this thing that my pals and I used to do where we would drive to Chicago or drive to Detroit, depending on how much money we had. And if you had enough gas money to get there, we had like, my pal Tyler had a giant van. And if you had enough gas money to get there, you would undoubtedly run into someone else who would need a ride like back, you know, back east, where we were heading, and they would chip in enough gas money to get us home in or Detroit, you know, like all of these things. It just made for this release. You could see shows, you know, there's this Instagram account now run by Chris Gutierrez, who I don't know if y'all know the Fall Out Boy song. It's like, hey, Chris, you are our only friend, etc. That's that Chris, where he's like posting old Chicago punk and hardcore flyers. And it's so wild for me. So I'm like, yo, these were the shows, right? Where you could like bring a canned good and pay $3 and see like 9 bands, you know? And there was something really freeing about that for me, you know? Especially because, you know, I grew up in a very, my neighborhood I grew up in was largely Black. And my experience on the scene was that, you know, there was never a point in my life where I didn't believe there were Black punks, you know? Because the people who were surrounding me at these shows, the people who I was writing, so they were all mostly Black, right? And so, like, it was also really thrilling for me to kind of be in an environment where it was like, okay, like, my people are also punks, and these are my pals, and this is how we're operating. So I felt both welcome and unwelcome all at once on the scene. I think on the good days, the welcoming feeling outweighed the unwelcoming feeling. In terms of writing, you know, I think I love music, and I demand for the music I love to be taken seriously. I think that, and I want to write about it seriously. You know, a funny thing, this isn't punk or emo, but I've written about members of One Direction a couple times. And one of the nicest emails I'd ever gotten, because I'm very much like big on like dialogue with people who love music. And that's kind of what I want to bring to my work. I want it to, if I am curious about music or excited about music, I want to take it seriously. I want to treat it seriously. And I want, and so I, you know, I'm sure there are people who scoff at the fact that the centerpiece of They Can't Kill Us is a massive essay about Fall Out Boy, or people that might even roll their eyes when I'm right about like women in pop music, like people who are kind of like, gosh, you've written about Carly Rae Jepsen so many times. But it's because I believe these artists have had an impact on either my life or the lives of people I care about to the point where my curiosity demands that I take them seriously.
Yeah. I am a huge Carly Rae Jepsen fan, and I feel like she does not get taken seriously at all. So I really appreciate you writing about her.
Yeah.
Me too. Yeah, she's a queen for sure. I wanted to ask you one question sort of about what's going on right now and just kind of how you feel like this Black Lives Matter movement is different from racial justice movements in the past and what you think the impact of us being in quarantine, like living through this pandemic and really being at home and able to process everything and really focus on what's going on more so than before, where we were so distracted by our busy lives, by everything going on, and how you think that is adding value and sort of adding this level of like being able to add time and our focus onto doing our part in changing, you know, trying to change the future.
I mean, I think people have three things, at least I can speak for only Columbus where I've been on the ground doing work and all that. People have time, energy, and rage. And I think just really, I don't know. I've been kind of hesitant to speak on like how it is different because I don't want to, you know, at first I think I was speaking on that with some clarity, but then I thought, well, am I just missing past movements? Because I think this movement exists because of every movement before it, right? Because of people who lived through and witnessed and then went out and rebuilt. And so I think there is a more effective channeling because there's time and because there's energy, there's more ability to effectively channel that rage. Also, a thing that's real is I think there are just more people out in the streets because more people are angry because we have seen kind of plainly the governmental failures on almost every level laid out like really bare in the pandemic, right? And so even if someone was like maybe, yes, mad about racialized violence or mad about institutional racism, but maybe like, is the type of person who's like, I'm mad about this, so I'm kind of going to stay inside and send emails, which is also good work. But then, like, I feel like with the pandemic failures, as those people are like, I'm going to get outside. And then when those people come outside, I think what they're seeing, and again, I'm speaking for here, people are seeing that everything that has been said about policing specifically by marginalized folks is true, right? And so I've been out at protests in Columbus where police are hitting people with bikes, dragging people in the streets, throwing people down. And I've been around people who are like, oh, you can tell, you see it, the gears turning in their head. We're like, oh, that does happen. This isn't, you know, that does happen unprovoked. This violence is something that is visited upon Black folks in America, brown folks in America, marginalized folks in America. And so I think seeing that firsthand is really shifted a lot of narratives here, or it shifted a lot of, and people are just more hip to the bullshit, for lack of a better word. People understand who escalates and then who gets punished for a response to that escalation. The other thing is, for me, I'm really enlivened by the generation of young activists who are doing work. And I'm thinking specifically of, here we have CPD out of CCS, where it's like young high school students or just recently graduated high school students fighting to get Columbus police out of Columbus City Schools. And they're like doing it, you know? And I think about when I was a high school senior, just would have never, you know, like, and I say this as someone who was raised very justice-minded, who has been on the ground in many ways in many years before this one. But like as a 17-year-old high school senior, I wasn't fighting to get police out of schools. I grew up being fucked with the police a lot, but I never thought, you know, it seemed like they were an immovable object. They were just a fabric. They were woven into the fabric of my life, and I had to endure being fucked with by police. But I think what we're seeing now is a younger generation of activists who have imaginations far beyond what my imagination was, what many people's imaginations were when they were 17 in eras past. And that makes me so excited. I think that is going to be really what helps move us forward.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't think I would have done any of this in high school, to be honest. So I totally feel you on that. We don't want to take up too much of your time. We'll just throw one last question at you.
If you have more questions other than the one, definitely throw them at me. This is great. I know that y'all have a time limit, but this has been amazing. Wonderful.
I was just wondering if, like, you have, if you have any, like, newer emo or pop punk artists that you're into, or if you really keep up with the newer acts out there, or if you kind of just revisit.
No, I keep up with some of the new acts. I mean, I keep up with a lot of, like, punk hardcore emo acts. I mean, a group I always want to big up is Fuck You Pay Us. You know, I just turned in my next book of nonfiction, which is out next year, and I wrote about them in it, because I wrote about, like, seeing them in concert and how it was just, like, really revelatory for me. It was just like, you know, I happened to be in LA, or I think they played in LA. Yeah, I happened to be in LA, and someone was kind of like, come check out this band. And I'm still very much someone where if someone's like, come check out this band, and I trust that person, I'll go check out the band. And it was just like really emotionally revelatory experience to kind of see, one, to see the crowd at their show, to see that many Black folks, and specifically Black queer folks, who were just like, and you know, so much of, I think, I don't want to get into the whole thing because I've wrote about it in the book, but so much of like an unnuanced view of Fuck You Pay Us is like, well, their shows are, you know, they're ferocious and angry and all that, but it's love. It's like there's a lot of love at that show. There's a lot of affection at that show. I think this has, I mean, my theory is that this has to do with non-Black people's inability to read Black anger as something that pushes towards affection, but that's a whole other thing. I like Future Teens. I think the last Future Teens album was really good. I always blank, I know they're not new, but I go back and forth with Neck Deep. I like some of Neck Deep stuff and other stuff, you know, but I think they're evolving in a good way. Who are y'all on right now?
I mean, I really, really like Movements. Have you ever checked them out?
Yeah.
They have a new song out that's pretty good too, but the reason that I've started liking them initially is because their songs, especially in the past, used to be very almost like poetry. And yeah, it was almost like spoken word over emo music. And I'd never really seen that in that way. And it's been really cool to watch them grow and see them, you know, progress as a band.
Yeah. They have a new song. When did the new song come out?
Friday.
I'm not hip.
So like a week ago. Oh, yeah. It's so great. And then I also really like this band Stand Atlantic. They're from Australia, and obviously I love the fact that they have a female singer.
But
we have a Spotify playlist. I'll send it to you after this, and we try to add whatever new music we're into. We obviously have hundreds of songs from, you know, that are obvious, like Chiodo's, Fall Out Boy, all that kind of stuff, but we tried out as many new artists on there as possible. I don't know if you've heard of Grandson. Grandson's, I love Grandson.
Yeah.
The what?
Wait, who?
Yeah, Youngblood.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Youngblood's pretty cool. If I have struggled to grow an affection for Youngblood, where should I, like, how should I be listening?
Well, I feel like I saw him live, and like that's what really like sold me on him. He's like, I mean, which again, like, who knows when that will happen?
Yeah,
yeah, that's exactly what I was just gonna say. You have to see him live.
Yeah, it was crazy to see him live. Like, I was
wild. Surprised at how
good. That's like, that's good to know. I mean, and I'm someone who can easily be turned by a live show. I mean, as I wrote about, like, Carly Rae Jepsen was someone I was not very into until I saw her live, and it was like, I get everything that's happening. I'm like fully on board. So I'll have to put, I mean, if we are ever allowed to go to live shows again, I'll have to put that.
Yeah. But I'm trying to think. I mean, I don't know. I think it's because I first saw him live and then I went to listen to his songs that now I really do like his songs, but I also understand why it's kind of hard to connect with it. I think his audience is also very young leaning, and I think he tries to appeal to the, but which is also cool because he's super politically active And it's great that he has a young audience, and it's kind of what you were saying, how all these kids in high school are taking a stand and doing all these great things. I think he's a huge part of that, which is nice to see, because I think a lot of musicians shy away from having a voice in politics or in any social issues, which, you know, isn't the best.
Yeah, now's not the time. Especially if you got a young audience, you know, now is definitely not the time. I think being aware of who's consuming your work as an artist and how influential your voice is vital.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Carol, I skipped over your one question, so go for it.
Oh, okay. I guess this kind of goes along with what we're talking about, actually. I was just going to ask you how you think music and poetry or other art can help fuel movements, like what's happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I believe that the art itself is revolutionary. You know, I think I did once. I was once like, a poem can change the world. But I think for me, only speaking for me, my work alone does not move the needle, I think. But this is why I often say that I think my writing work and my creative work is very separate from my movement work. Because here, I think when I'm asked to show up, it's very rarely as a writer. I mean, I've been saying that a lot recently, is that like the ways that I'm asked to show up in Columbus is like, can you extract people from protests? Can you do supply runs? It's not like, can you come and read that thing you wrote, you know? But I mean, I do think that good writing or good music or these things can offer clarity. They can offer newer, better language with which to approach the movement. They can also offer some kind of resurgence or revitalization. Good music, good writing helps me remember that I'm not alone. Also helps me remember that this is not the first time something like this has happened, and that it is my responsibility to continue kind of working along the path that has been set. So I love the way that music and writing can contextualize, but the art alone, I don't think, does anything unless the person who's making the art is also perhaps attempting to, you know, live towards whatever their version of justice is, if they are capable of doing so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we really will let you go now. This was awesome. We're honestly just so honored to talk to you. We're just huge fans.
This was great. And I love your Blockbuster shirt.
Oh, thank you.
It's really great. I worked at a Blockbuster. I briefly worked at a Blockbuster.
Really?
Yeah, it was great. It was, well, I don't know. It wasn't great, but it was fine.
Yeah. R.I.P. Blockbuster.
R.I.P., yeah.
That's it.
All right. Have
Thanks,
a good rest
y'all.
Of your day.
I appreciate it.
Bye.
You too.
Bye.
Ever heard of Stoicism? Chances are, if you have, you've heard of Stoicism with a lowercase s and not Stoicism with an uppercase s. Lone wolves, no emotions, antisocial behavior, cold indifference. All that is Stoicism with a lowercase s. Stoicism with an uppercase s is the ancient Greek philosophy and virtue ethics framework that centers on service to the cosmopolis, to include your family, friends, community, and planet, and the development of a good moral character. My name is Tanner Campbell, and I'm the host of Practical Stoicism, a 3 times a week podcast teaching Stoic principles and concepts to anyone interested through the exploration of texts and deep dives into various moral topics. You can find Practical Stoicism where you're already listening to podcasts by searching for Practical Stoicism or by going to stoicismpod.com. I invite you to give it a listen today. You just might like it.